one of the most damaging spies in history. We're telling the story of Klaus Fuchs, the man who stole America's atomic secrets and gave them to Stalin's Soviet Union, changing the course of the 20th century. It's the story of a man caught up in a web of betrayal and deceit.
We are very excitingly going to start a little series here on this theoretical physicist, Klaus Fuchs, whose name is probably not very well known, Gordon, but who was, I think, probably fair to say, one of the most influential spies of the 20th century, because he was responsible for passing the actual plans of the atom bomb to the Soviets. And in that wonderful theatrical reading you just gave, Gordon, Klaus Fuchs is actually there at Los Alamos for the Trinity test, as seen in the movie Oppenheimer. And he, all the while, is working to build this bomb, and he's also giving the secrets of the science to the Russians. And so I think it's probably fair to say, I mean, we could have a long debate about this, Gordon, but the creation of the atom bomb, probably one of the most momentous events of the 20th century. And there's a real espionage undercurrent to this whole story as well, which is what I think makes Klaus Fuchs and the story we're going to tell so interesting.
That's right. I mean, in the film Oppenheimer, the focus is on whether Oppenheimer is a security risk and, you know, whether he's somehow secretly a communist. But the real story behind it, which you just get glimpses of in the film, that actually the real source of the leak of the information getting to the Soviet Union is Klaus Fuchs. And he plays a kind of bit part in that film, but actually he's a central part in the story of whatever happens. And I mean, there's this fascinating quote from the historian of the British bomb, which says the parentage of the British, Russian, and American hydrogen bombs has long been debated, but I suspect Klaus Fuchs was grandfather to them all. So what you get there is a sense of the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb, one type of bomb. In that case, Klaus Fuchs actually plays a pivotal role in three countries getting the nuclear bomb, one man.
It's a real atomic hat trick, isn't it, for Klaus Fuchs? And, yeah. And nobody knows his name. I mean, I think the reason, and I actually just rewatched Oppenheimer last night, and I think one of the reasons why his story, and I think really the story of Klaus Fuchs, is so fascinating and why we're so interested in it, is because there is this fascination, I think, with people who make or are involved in making really earth-shattering technology and how they think about their responsibilities to the world, how they think about the morality of what they're doing, and why they make the choices that they do. And you see throughout the movie Oppenheimer this deep sense of, I think, moral confusion or being conflicted about creating this super weapon to defeat the Nazis, potentially win the Second World War, and then what happens afterward? What happens when this thing is unleashed on the world? And of course, the great biography of Oppenheimer, on which the Christopher Nolan movie is based, is called American Prometheus. You know, it's sort of taking this idea of fire being stolen from the gods, brought to humans. What do we do with that responsibility once we have it? And I think we see this today with characters like Elon Musk in space exploration, or Sam Altman in artificial intelligence, is kind of what role do these people have, or what choices do they make as they develop, you know, and sort of commercialize this kind of tech? And what we'll see in this story is that Klaus Fuchs, this theoretical physicist, very interesting background in Germany, he's wrestling throughout with these very important decisions about who gets what information. And really, I think, why should just the US and Great Britain have a bomb? Why not the Russians as well? And we'll see through his sort of morality tale why he makes the decisions that he does. But he's kind of one of these characters who's just deeply embedded in probably the most profound, or one of the most profound, tech advances of the entire 20th century.
That's right. You feel like we should write to Christopher Nolan and say, make a film Fuchs rather than as a follow-up to Oppenheimer.
Fuchs.
I don't think it doesn't sound
Fuchs.
As good though, does it?
Somehow? No, you would, Fuchs with an exclamation point on the end. That could be the, the movie.
He is this great character though. And I mean, there's a quote from the US Congress in 1951. Fuchs alone has influenced the safety of more people and accomplished greater damage than any other spy, not only in the history of the United States, but in the history of nations. So that gives a sense of his consequence. But also, I mean, I don't like heroes and villains and simple heroes and villains, but it would be very easy to go villain. And that quote from the US Congress goes villain. But actually, one of the things I found the more I looked at his story was I don't think he fits into that category of hero or villain. I think he's a much more complicated and interesting character because of the kind of inner turmoil and the reasons for why he does what he does when it comes to spying. So I'm not saying I'm entirely sympathetic to this communist spy, but
Well, I mean, listeners to our podcast will, of course, be completely unsurprised to find Gordon Carrera voicing sympathies for traitors to the crown, traitors to the United States. We've yet found another pasty nerd for you to be... to treat very well during the course of our series.
Which there's a theme here.
It's
what I want to be. I'm projecting what I'd like to be, one of those pasty nerds. The nerds shall inherit the earth. Anyway, let's get to the story.
Yes.
Let's talk about Fuchs himself, where he comes from, how he ends up working on the atomic program. And it goes back to Germany, doesn't it? That's where his story starts.
Yes, it starts in Germany. The young Fuchs, and I think what we should say that neither of us, is it fair to say, Gordon, neither of us speak German very well? Now, you might be laying a trap for me.
Ein bisschen.
Oh, you told me. So Gordon lied to me before we started recording this podcast and said that he didn't speak German. And now,
okay, anyway,
I've been led into a trap.
I'm going to let you do the pronunciation.
Yeah, go on. Yeah. I entered a lot of German names yesterday in the Google program that allows you to then hear what they sound like. And I've repeated them. So you can be the judge. So Klaus Fuchs is born in 1911 in Rüsselsheim, which I believe it's south of Frankfurt, but he grows up in Eisenach. Is it Eisenach? Eisenach, which is northeast of Frankfurt. It is in what will eventually become East Germany. Eisenach is the home of Bach. Luther went to school there. So class of, 1512 or whatever, very, very strong class in Eisenach. And Klaus, he's an animal lover. He becomes a vegetarian at an early age because he's sort of horrified by the killing of animals. And in kind of a theme throughout his life, he suffers from a variety of ailments. He becomes anemic. He's sent to Switzerland for treatments. And you see in kind of his very early life, this kind of frequent illness, and frankly, the kind of dip into left-wing pacifism themes throughout his life. Now, he is a quiet and pale kid, hence your sympathy for him, Gordon. He, for those wondering what he looks like, he is a nerd out of Central Casting. He has wire-rimmed glasses, a five head, big cheeks. He looks like a less well-fed, more somber and Germanic version, in my opinion, of, and this is a somewhat obscure reference, I don't know how this movie did in the UK, of Rick Moranis from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Now, did that movie do well over there?
Yeah, it did okay, but Rick Moranis, I'm vaguely aware, but I think a lot of people won't know, but I think, glasses and serious looking.
Very serious looking, yes. Big glasses, big forehead. His father's a Lutheran pastor, and he's got two sisters and an older brother. Now, I think there are three things to note about the young Fuchs that really set up his life and his personality and the decisions that he is going to make down the line. The first one is that he comes of age in a post-war, and by that I mean post-World War I Germany, of shortages, economic anxiety, hyperinflation, and a lot of this pain in this period is seen as imposed on Germany from abroad, right? In the settlement after the First World War. It is an extremely unstable time in Germany. When Klaus is 11, a loaf of bread will cost 160 marks. By the end, of 1923, when he's 12, it'll cost 200 million marks. So you get a sense of sort of the roiling anxiety of much of his childhood. So that's one. Two, he is a mathematics prodigy. And he is, quote, known and famous, according to one of his biographers, by the time he's maybe 10. And he is seen in Eisenach as probably the best student in mathematics. And three, he grows up in a highly political household, in a highly political era in Germany, one in which, you think about politics as being something that's maybe done over the news or, in arguments and debates. It's a really kind of violent time in Germany, and there's a lot of clashing and just kind of street brawling, frankly, in German political life in this era between the far right, the Nazis, and a bunch of parties on the left.
His family, though, is particularly interesting and important, isn't it? Because his father, you know, is a Lutheran pastor, but I think he then moves to kind of Quakerism and pacifism. His father spent some time in Manchester working amongst the kind of slums of Manchester, which, interesting enough, is also where kind of Karl Marx, years before, had got his socialism from. And you feel like, you know, this is also something which feeds into Fuchs's father, this kind of both the religion and the empathy with the downtrodden. And so that side of things definitely feeds into Fuchs. And I think also this idea that his father seems to instill in him of following your conscience wherever that takes you, even if it's in conflict to what his family or others might think around him. And I think that idea seems to come quite strongly from his father, but it is it's quite strange and quite a difficult family, isn't it? I mean, he later says, I had a very happy childhood, and yet it does sound like a pretty dark or strange childhood in some ways.
That's right. And his father is just, he's sort of a political animal, and they're nicknamed the Red Foxes. Fuchs means fox in German. And just sort of describing the politics in the home, they are part of the Social Democrat Party in Germany at the time, which I think is kind of a social equality and justice platform, but it's happening in the context of a democratic process, right? Unlike perhaps communists, and certainly the Nazis on the right. And that is, I think, really the critical bit of the politics of his childhood, is that the household, his father, the sort of dinner table conversations, it's vehemently anti-Nazi from a very early age.
But we should say a word about his mother. Tragically, she kills herself when Klaus Fuchs is 19. And supposedly, when his father comes and finds her, she's died from drinking acid. And her dying words are, "Mother, I am coming," which is a reference to her own mother, who's also committed suicide. And so there is a kind of dark undercurrent, I think, to his family, and quite a sad undercurrent, which seems to be there, including around mental health. And that's part of the story. And yet again, kind of Fuchs almost kind of doesn't want to talk about it. He kind of doesn't cover it up, but he doesn't want to refer to it in any way.
His biographer, Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, who's written a wonderful book on Klaus Fuchs, notes that he'll only acknowledge it when he has to fill it out on administrative forms, you know, that his mother is deceased, and he'll write the cause as political reasons.
That's fascinating, isn't it? To say she killed herself for political reasons. I mean, it almost implies he might associate it with the kind of politics of the time rather than what was going on in her head. But it's, I don't know, it's just a really interesting thing to have noted down. So he's there in this really kind of complicated family, I guess, and at a time when politics in Germany is getting pretty intense as the 1930s move on. And he's growing up in this really kind of adversarial period.
So he goes to university in Leipzig, which is a Nazi bastion of support in Leipzig. So Klaus is a total fish out of water there. Now, interestingly enough, you sort of know your politics are messed up when all of the parties have paramilitary groups. And he joins the Social Democrats paramilitary group, the Reichsbanner, joins it with his brother. He is involved in a lot of actually street fighting. You would not think, given the way this guy looks, that he would be very physical, but he is. He's involved in a lot of street fighting and kind of street action against the Nazis when he's at Leipzig. His physics professor is Werner Heisenberg, who is also in the movie Oppenheimer and who is going to win the Nobel Prize very soon. Klaus is apparently bored there because Heisenberg doesn't lecture on any of the interesting stuff. This is a theme again throughout his life. And I think it links back to, Gordon, what you were talking about with his father, I think, instilling in these kids that you should, how would we even describe it? It's almost the sense of moral certitude and the need to follow up what you believe with action. Like, you can't just believe it in your head. So he's going to join these kind of social democrat student groups and organize for them. He's really at the forefront of this anti-Nazi activism. And, you know, I think you can kind of see in this period, you've got the activism, the struggle with the Nazis, the reaction to his mother's death, which, by the way, that is the seventh suicide in the family line. So you have this deeply unsettled family environment, this deeply unsettled political environment. But in the midst of all this, Klaus is very tough. He's single-minded. He's looking at the world through the lens of a place lacking justice and fairness, of sort of capitalism riding on the backs of workers. And his father in this period is going to write that Klaus, like all his siblings, has this kind of unbending character, very one-sided. And if he believes that something is right, that's the way it is, and you need to take action to do something about it. So in this period, though, we should say he's decidedly, I think, not a communist, right? He's not involved with the German Communist Party at this point. His family, while certainly maybe flirting with the edges of it, they're not actually part of that political movement. But in 1932, the Social Democrats back Hindenburg, who's sort of this old school conservative, you know, military man, and they promote him and sort of support his candidacy to be president of the Weimar Republic. And this is a deeply agitating moment for Klaus. He kind of sees this as a betrayal of the working class. And what this moment kind of comes to for him is that there's a rift between Klaus Fuchs and these kind of social democratic groups on campus. And Klaus, in this rift, is taken in by the German Communist Party. Now, there's an election in that year. Again, a lot of street action. Klaus apparently loses three teeth in a street brawl, and he takes up leadership of this communist group called the Red Spark. It is a kind of roving political theater and agitprop brigade. Great excuse to say that word. They roam the countryside kind of doing skits, singing, dancing, promoting anti-Nazi political ideology. He probably believes a lot of the same things that he did when he was part of this kind of social democratic group, but now he is actually in the kind of communist firmament.
He's a kind of activist, to some extent, a brawler. I mean, he gets into fights, doesn't he? So he's really involved in that and moving in that. And just as the Nazis now are coming to power and in which they're going to go after the communists.
That's right. So in January of 1933, Hitler becomes chancellor. Nazi power is kind of growing throughout Germany. And that trickles down, I think, to these student groups where they try to shut down the kind of communist student clubs. There's more brawling. Klaus Fuchs, anti-Nazi throughout. But he, in early 1933, gets into another brawl with Nazi students. They throw him into a fjord and leave him for dead, right? So you have, at this point, I think, a family that is starting to be deeply persecuted by the Nazis. And if you think about the way he described his mother's suicide, in his mind, there's probably a straight line from her psychological distress to the rise of the Nazi party. Now, he survives this. He goes into hiding, but the Nazis have put him on kind of a kill list. In February of 1933, there's a fire at the Reichstag.
Reichstag, the German parliament. Yep.
The German parliament, where it's essentially blamed on the communists, this fire. There are raids and roundups that begin across the country. Klaus is on his way to a meeting of socialist students in Berlin when he hears about this fire. And this is, I think, a pivotal sort of moment for him in his life. He's on the train and he's got a pin on his shirt. It's the hammer and sickle sort of lapel pin to signify that he's a communist. The police are searching for him. He's kind of thinking that he's going to have to go on the run. He takes the pin off, the communist pin, and hides it. And at this point in 1933, Klaus Fuchs's political activism starts to go underground, and he is becoming part of the communist underground in Germany.
So with that moment, Klaus Fuchs on the run from the Nazis, going underground, we'll take a break, and afterwards we'll find out how he ends up in Britain. Welcome back. We're looking at the story of Klaus Fuchs, and he is now on the run from the Nazis, from the Gestapo hunting for him because they know he's a communist activist.
Well, that's right. And now after the Reichstag fire, the whole communist party in Germany is having to go underground, Klaus Fuchs with it. He starts to get actually in this period, I think, his first education in kind of basic tradecraft, right? Because the whole party now has to exist out of sight of the Nazi security services. And so they're sort of establishing these points of connection on oral messages only, code names. We sadly don't actually know what Fuchs's code name was in this period. It has not survived. You know, don't keep names on a list. Don't sleep at home. Don't look backward in a very obvious way to see if you're being followed. Wear disguises. Now he's in Berlin. It's 1933. He has an aunt there. She's conservative. And the Gestapo pays her a visit to try to understand where Fuchs is. And she dutifully hands over the address where she thinks Klaus is staying. So he's sort of betrayed in this period by his own aunt. But he has given her a fake address. And we should note that the persecution in this period by the Nazis of communists is absolutely brutal. You know, there are raids, hangings, torture. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands of communists are sort of arrested or forced to flee. The former communist presidential candidate is arrested, tortured, and thrown into a camp, later dies there. The party headquarters in Berlin is overrun, and the leadership starts to flee, to get out of Germany, go to places like Denmark and France. And Klaus, in this period, is working as a recruiter for the Red Student Group in Berlin. The combat in this period is primarily writing up pamphlets and flyers and printing newsletters. And in his spare time, going back to this sort of math prodigy, he's registered to study math and physics at the University of Berlin. His father is arrested, eventually found guilty of pro-communist sympathies, but serves only a month in prison. His brother, Gerhard, is arrested, spends 2 years in prison, but he's got all these, you know, health problems. And after his release, he ends up at a sanatorium in Switzerland. His wife and son end up being trapped outside Prague. It's very sad. They sort of vanish into a concentration camp. His two sisters are forced to flee Germany. And we say all this to note that it is in this period, in the early 1930s, when the Nazis have taken power, that Klaus Fuchs's family life, which I think was always unsettled. I think it would be easy, or would be easy to imagine the sort of person who would give up the activism and just sort of try to survive, you know, through this.
You get a picture of a guy who is anti-Nazism is absolutely at the core of what he believes in. That's his driving force. And activism, doing things, not remaining silent, but actually taking action. Those are the two defining things. And I guess that becomes the core of understanding who Klaus Fuchs is, you know, in later years. It's formed here in that kind of just that year or two, isn't it? Around 1932, 1933, which is critical because eventually he realizes, I think, that he's got to get out of Germany. He's got to run.
He's a true believer. And at this stage, I'm not sure he's a true believer in sort of Soviet communism, but he's a true believer in social justice, this kind of redistributive politics around promoting the working class at the expense of the rich. And it's just, it's maybe summed up negatively as kind of, he's anti-Nazi.
But it's a very interesting parallel, isn't it? Because around this, almost exactly the same time, Kim Philby is getting recruited to the communist cause as well in the UK, kind of 33, 34, you know, the kind of years around then when he's come out of Cambridge. And it is quite similar where at that point, people who were anti-Nazi also thought the only people standing up to the Nazis were the communists. So, you know, there is an element of kind of being pro-communist, but there's also an element of being fundamentally anti-Nazi first. And that being the kind of driving motivation. It does feel like that for kind of Fuchs and Philby, where it's ideology which is driving them, but the future is either kind of Nazism or communism in a way.
And Fuchs has seen that in a very real way with the compromises that the Social Democrats, the sort of party of his family, have made with these kind of conservative parties in Germany. I think the only party that's really held fast has been the communists, right? And so he's attracted to that, I think, quite naturally. So mid-July of 1933, Klaus, like so many German communists, flees from Berlin. He crosses into Belgium on foot and heads to Paris. He is 21 years old. He speaks absolutely no French. And he's there in kind of this pretty interesting swirl of communist sympathizers and actual members of the Comintern who are in Paris for this kind of youth congress in the summer of that year. Now, Paris is kind of going to be a way station for him. His father, as we had mentioned earlier in the episode, had spent some time in Britain, and he'd actually worked for a Quaker family in Bristol. And his father puts in word with relatives to try to get Klaus sent from France to England.
This is one of the interesting bits of the story, is because he gets the opportunity to go and stay with this family in Bristol, the Gunn family. And they're quite left-wing, I think. And so there is a kind of network of people who are all sympathetic. They're not activists in the sense of being spies, though, but they are sympathetic. And there is also this idea of kind of hospitality you get from people. And that Fuchs is one of a lot of people at this time who is actually kind of welcomed as a refugee into the UK, fleeing Nazism. And also into the scientific community, I think, at this time, because he's kind of recognized as being kind of a prodigy in this way. And so it is interesting that he is given refuge, literally, by both the country, but also by families and individuals who kind of take him in and look after him, initially here in Bristol, I think.
And Bristol is a sort of bastion of left-wing politics, even to this day.
Is it
that,
David?
Right, Gordon?
Thank you, David.
I've been told by my British sources that it's a big lefty university even now.
It's pretty lefty. I think it's known for a degree of left-wing activism, a bit of tearing down statues and the like. That's the Bristol way. So yeah, I think it was in those days maybe as well, judging by Fuchs's circumstances and time there.
Well, that's right. And Fuchs is the real Bristol man. He joins the university's socialist society. He's distributing pamphlets. And by the fall of 1934, he needs identity documents to stay in Britain because he's a refugee, essentially. He manages to get these by registering with the police. And then in something that's going to be absolutely critical for the later parts of our story, in the process of getting these documents, information comes from Germany to the constable in Bristol that eventually gets sent to MI5 with a note summarizing Klaus as a, quote, notorious communist.
This is a really important theme that we're going to be looking at throughout this series, which is, how did they miss him? How did MI5, the security service, miss the fact that first he'd come to the UK and then, you know, that he gets access to some of the UK and the US's most closely guarded secrets? And this is the first time, really, in 1934. And it's really interesting because they're asking whether there's any evidence of anything untoward about him. And they have got this report that's come out of Germany saying, as you said, that he's a communist activist. But the issue is, at MI5, Guy Liddell, who's one of the kind of chief investigators at MI5, we should say MI5 at this point is tiny. It's just a kind of few dozen officers. But he's just been to Germany in 1933, and he knows that the Germans are obsessed with communists and are seeing communists everywhere and are determined to go after them, to purge them. And so he basically discounts anything that they get from the German police. He just assumes that this is the kind of Germans ranting about communists and to some extent puts it to one side because of the source, because it's come from, you know, effectively the Gestapo. So you can kind of see why he might do that, but it's certainly the first of many misses, I think.
And we should also say in this period that this is prior to any of the kind of public knowledge about Stalin's purges. And it would be very common to have sort of these left-wing sympathies for the Soviet Union or for communism in general. And so I'd have to think that's also being factored into MI5's calculation here. You know, the accusation that he's a communist is not hitting as hard in 1934 as it would in 1954.
So effectively, he gets allowed to stay. He gets a clean bit of health at this point.
That's right. And so by 1936, he finishes his degree. He receives approval to do a PhD. And now there's competition over seats for German refugees in the physics department. And so Fuchs is sent to Edinburgh to work under Max Born.
Edinburgh, but sorry.
I said Edinburgh, didn't I?
Edinburgh. Let's move on.
Are you pronouncing it in your German, Gordon?
No, I'm pronouncing it in my British. I'm not going to say English. Anyway.
Edinburgh. Okay. So he goes to Edinburgh and he studies under Max Born, who's also a German physicist. And there are just Germans everywhere outside of Germany in this period. I think in our story today, basically every name we mention will be a future Nobel Prize winner. He's also going to win a Nobel. And I think the equivalent of studying atomic physics under Max Born is sort of like a student studying gravity under Newton. He's the man. And this is a period where also he's actually now, he seems to actually be doing studying, right? And contributing at the university. He's described by Born as the best of his age group. He's also involved in the German communist underground in Edinburgh. And it does seem like Born probably knew that Klaus Fuchs was a communist. But again, he's kind of just another leftist intellectual. He probably supports the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War, like Philby would have. Nothing particularly strange about that. And then in August of 1939, disaster strikes the family again. His sister kills herself by jumping from a train into a ravine. And again, Fuchs is going to describe the reasons for that as political.
Amazing, isn't it? This idea, political reasons, the way to describe both your mother and your sister's death. by having killed themselves. I mean, it's just a really kind of odd insight. But August 1939, of course, is also the moment where the Second World War is literally about to break out. And Britain's going to be going to war with Germany.
Well, and at first, there's really, I think, no effort to kind of separate the actual Nazi sympathizers, and in some cases, POWs, from the very anti-Nazi Germans who'd fled to Great Britain, Klaus Fuchs among them. And so Klaus is, he's working at this point in Edinburgh on a grant from the Carnegie Trust. He's a refugee. He's a Category C refugee, which means he has very few restrictions on his travel and movement, but he's lumped in with this group of, quote, enemy aliens. And in spring of 1940, he's detained and put into this kind of miserable military transit camp. First, he goes to Liverpool, and then he's kind of blending in with these groups of people who are communist emigres from the German resistance, veterans of the Spanish Civil War. The camp conditions are atrocious. One man hangs himself. There's very little food, no access to outside mail or radio. And unsurprisingly, I think internment really deepens Fuchs's suspicions of his potentially, you know, adoptive country. And interning basically all of these anti-fascists to, in Fuchs's mind, sort of appease the kind of nativist camp in Britain. And Fuchs will say, you know, the goal here was not to establish freedom and democracy, but to continue to attempt shameful compromises with the Nazis. Now, he's eventually moved to an internment facility on the Isle of Man, which I only associate as a money laundering destination.
Look away, listeners from the Isle of Man, right? Now, yeah, it's a kind of island between the mainland and an island. I was trying to kind of work out a kind of parallel. I guess it's the equivalent of sending people to Guantanamo Bay. It's a kind of offshore island, not quite under the main jurisdiction of the country. So they're packed off there first, all these Germans. Again, pretty bad conditions. And then they're sent even further away by boat to Canada. I mean, they really are trying to kind of move them out, you know, as far as they can. And I think the first boat that goes gets sunk by the Germans. And then he's on the second boat, which makes it out to Canada.
So he goes from Britain's Gitmo to someplace even worse. He's sent to Canada.
Soon to be the 51st state. Anyway,
soon to be the 51st state.
Let's not get into that.
So the conditions on this boat are also horrific. There's a refugee memoir that said the pissoirs were filled with vomit and shit, and the waste became ankle deep. Klaus is going to later claim that the communists were the ones who took the lead in the cleanup. They were doing this without rubber gloves, so just wading into these pools of feces to clean up the ship. The crossing, again, they have to take a very kind of northerly route to avoid U-boats, German U-boats. The crossing takes 10 days instead of 4, so it's just an absolutely disastrous experience. They go to Quebec at a place called Camp L. They're strip searched. All their valuables are taken. Fuchs is 5'10". I don't know how to convert that into your metric system, Gordon. And he weighs a measly, 126 pounds. And so he is not healthy, let's say. Everyone is so thirsty that in some of these refugee accounts, they'll write years later that they could still remember the first glass of water they got when they got to the camp. They're eating bread and something called bully beef, which is a kind of gelatinous meat, and I'm
corn
sure
beef, tinned corn beef, for those who remember it. Jelly, gelatinous stuff around it. It's not very appetizing, but nutritious, I think.
We feed our dog. They have these like
yeah,
bully.
It does look like dog food.
It's kind of what I had imagined. So in the camp, Fuchs he's quiet, but he's remembered as a Marxist whose views were often aggravating to other people in the camp. And he becomes very close pals with a communist named Hans Kahle. And Hans Kahle is probably a talent spotter, I think we might say, for Soviet intelligence. And so we have here this sort of budding friendship between Klaus Fuchs and somebody who's at least friendly with the Soviet Union.
It's a friendship, maybe a bit more than that from Kahle's point of view, but Klaus Fuchs at this point doesn't have any secrets or anything like that. So it is just a kind of friendship, if you like, rather than the recruitment. But within this camp, I'm sure Kahle would have seen that Fuchs is a kind of remarkable individual. I mean, he's one of lots of kind of incredibly brainy people who are at that camp. You know, I mean, it's kind of bizarre thing where you've got all these anti-Nazi refugees, you know, who are all locked in together in this intense surroundings. And it kind of sounds almost like a kind of intellectual camp that they're running there. But also, there are people who realize that Klaus Fuchs is a kind of valuable mathematician and theoretical physicist and who want him back. And I think that's what's interesting about it, is because you get, I think, all the way through this sense of Klaus Fuchs's reasons why he could be a bit resentful about Britain. You know, he's been packed off to this pretty grim series of camps. But at the same time, there are people, particularly individuals and other scientists, who are doing their best for him, as he found hospitality at the start. Now, Max Born and others are saying, we need him back. You know, this is a kind of valuable man.
Well, and they actually, Max Born reaches out to Einstein and tries to get Einstein to send Klaus Fuchs reading material to the camp. The camp population is, I think, absolutely fascinating, because in that camp, at the same time as Fuchs, there's a future Nobel Prize winner in biochemistry, several creators or developers of the steady state theory of the universe, engineers, a few industrialists, journalists, painters, architects, and professors. And many of them will later be called Sir. This is the prison population. And the camp warden actually wrote later, some of the brainiest people in Canada were in the camp. It's like if you went to a university and like interned all of the professors and put them on a boat and sent them somewhere. And eventually, though, the Brits, Gordon, will come to their senses and realize that we probably shouldn't be interning all of these anti-Nazis with Nazi POWs. And so round about August of 1940, the government issues a white paper that starts to break these refugees down into more detailed categories, including finding some that would be eligible for release. And that would include scientists who might be able to help in the war effort. And of course, Klaus Fuchs is one of those. So eventually, Fuchs is going to be released. He'll be sent back to Britain. He'll reach Liverpool Harbor in January of 1941. He's been interned for about 8 months. And again, really critically, he has been joined at the hip with his close friend, Hans Kahle, who is this communist emigre and also has these connections to Soviet intelligence.
That's right. And it's interesting that in about April 1941, Fuchs comes down to London for what seems to be a party held in North London, partly, I think, partly to welcome him back. And it's at a very interesting place. So it's in Hampstead. I don't know how well you know Hampstead.
I'm a Hampstead man.
You're a Hampstead man. Hampstead, it's fair to say, has a reputation as the kind of home of the liberal left intelligentsia in London. It still does today.
That's me to a T, Gordon.
That's you to a T. Although these days, I think it's lost that slightly, because I think those people have been priced out by all the other people who've since arrived in London. But in those days, particularly, it had a kind of slightly radical edge. And particularly, he's taken to a party at this place called Lawn Road Flats in Hampstead. Now, this is really a fascinating place, because this isn't just a normal block of flats. It's a very kind of Bauhaus, modern, stylish block of flats, kind of white and modern. And it's filled with interesting people. Agatha Christie, by the way, at one point lives in this block of flats. But at this point, in the kind of early 30s, at number 7, you had living at one point Arnold Deutsch, who is the man who recruits Kim Philby and the Cambridge spies, and a man called Jürgen Kaczynski, who is also friends with Hans Kahle. And this is a kind of group of people who seem to be congregating here, who are communists, activists, and more. And it's a kind of fascinating place, which I think MI5 was only, you know, had some hints that something might have been going on there. But if they'd have known that this was actually the kind of epicenter, really, this one block of flats, of what would become communist recruitment in Britain, and I think they'd have been a lot more interested in it. But Fuchs seems to spend a lot of time there, you know, not just that party, but later. And it becomes a place where he's introduced to some interesting people.
And also, in this exact period, Fuchs is just now back from the camps, and he's trying to figure out where he's going to work next, right? What will he actually do? And he's not in it yet by the time he goes to this party, but he is being sort of wooed by Max Born to work on a particularly secretive program that I believe is worked under a contract for the Air Ministry, because the British atomic bomb project is underway at this point. And it's in spring of 41, or by the spring of 41, that Churchill has authorized work to begin on an atomic bomb. It's probably the case that you guys were even ahead of us at this point in sort of the science of how an atomic bomb would work. And so Fuchs, again, when he goes, and I think this April party is really a critical kind of point in his life, right? At this point, he's not in yet, right? He doesn't have access to the British atomic program, right? Because, again, he's just come out of the camps. He's kind of technically categorized as an enemy alien. He can't have access to all of these secretive science, but he's starting to kind of, you know, be considered for that. And so when he goes to this party in April, his friend Hans Galle introduces Fuchs to a man named Mr. Johnson, who speaks near perfect English, maybe with a little bit of an accent, and who's very interested in science, particularly in atomic energy. Now, again, MI5 believes that Hans Galle is a talent spotter for Soviet intelligence, and this Mr. Johnson is actually Simon Kramer, and he is an officer of Soviet military intelligence, the GRU.
So yes, I think at that point, we got Klaus Fuchs back in Britain and being courted by British scientists to work on this very secret program, which he's about to learn is the nuclear program, and at the same time, being introduced by his friends to officers of Soviet military intelligence. Those two things both happening around this same time in spring 1941. Let's leave it there. And next time we can come back and look at how he begins his career in espionage and stealing some of the most sensitive secrets that the country holds.
See you next time.